interesting. I kind of liked it myself, although I have a lot of friends who like to ski, and they're like wondering where the white stuff is to ski on. So, right, Nathaniel? That was, yeah, so that was good. But as I thought of the week, I thought, each week is an opportunity to either grow and move closer to the Lord or to drift away from Him. And over the course of years, then that would be the same, only in a larger extent. We used to, when you lived under a very legalist society like the Jewish society, you had a day that was dedicated to a mindfulness of God. And when that day came, you just didn't do other things. You just sat. And most of you would find that infinitely boring because football wasn't on the Sabbath then. And the other things that we amuse ourselves with. But, excuse me. But I'd like to challenge you each week to try to take some time in that we can evaluate at the end, you know, did I take enough time for the things that really matter to me? If it really matters to me to be a little more Christ-like, to learn a little bit more truth, then I should take time to do that, whether it's individually, with a group of friends, attending a fellowship, however that works for you. And then the other thing, and I don't think we could probably do this, but maybe next week I'll make you hold up a number. How much percentage of the week you stayed in fellowship? Just kidding. First of all, I'd have to define what in fellowship was, and then we'd argue about all those kind of things. But what I mean by that is how much time you were walking as closely as you could to the Lord. How much time you were mindful of Him as opposed to when you just let it slip and then you just stayed. Just being basically a Christian humanist, which is believing that maybe God exists, but not walking closely with Him. Yesterday, Val and I, Val's my wife, for those of you who don't know, Val and I hiked up Skyline. Now, it was kind of nice at the bottom. We're not exactly, you know, that's a long, steep ways for people my age, but we went up and we braved it all the way to the top, or at least the left side, which is the side I prefer to hike to anyway. But we noticed at the bottom that it was really calm and it was nice and it was right around freezing or so, and the sun was sort of out but hiding behind clouds, and there's a little mud, so I knew the sun had been shining on that trail, you know. We started going up, and the higher we got, it got a little colder, you know, the elevation changes things, gets a little chillier up there, and then it got a little windier too, and then when we got to the saddle, that part where you decide, you know, left or right or go back down, we decided to go left. And then we got up on that Bear Mountain, and the wind was out of the northeast, blowing pretty hard by then. By the time we got to the top, how many have been up there on a day when it's really windy? Any of you? Okay, appreciate that. But it was windy enough where if that was the edge, you didn't get real close because your balance wasn't. I don't think it was just because my legs were tired, but anyway, we kind of tucked in behind a little rock wall to get out of the wind for a bit. And it was interesting because I thought, you know, as long as we're there, it's pretty mellow out here. But as soon as you went back up to the top where you're just totally exposed to the wind, it was harsh. And I don't think, we were pretty well dressed, but we wouldn't last a really long time out there totally exposed on our own. And I don't want to spiritualize or too much anyway, or draw too far of an analogy, but my mind couldn't help but think that when we are hiding inside of God's care for us, when He is covering us, when we are staying, and another way to put it is within His moral framework, we are sheltered from the onslaught of the world without, the old sin nature within, and the attacks of the devil. But when we go out and stand alone, without that shield, we get hammered pretty good. You'd think, knowing that, that we wouldn't go out and stand alone, apart from God being with us. And yet we're so independent, we always think somehow we can pull it off. And I think Alaskans are the worst at this, you know, because we can do it, right? I don't care what the temperature is. I don't care if I'm on Skyline in my Speedo. I don't have one, by the way. But I can make it. I know I can because I'm an Alaskan. But the truth is we don't make it very long unless we seek the Lord and stay close to Him and ask Him to to help us through each week. For those of us that, those of you that have been here, we've been looking at the book of Matthew. And the title I gave it a few weeks ago is, What Will You Do With Jesus? And this is always the critical issue. It was the critical issue then, it's the critical issue now. And as Jackie spoke, when you bring that up boldly, there's a response. And it's not always an easy response. But what will you do with Jesus? It was the question in the book of Matthew. That's what he's trying to present to us. What will you do with this man, Jesus? Will you accept him as Jesus, God's Son? The propitiation for us, the justification for us, the access for us to be reunited with God? Or will you try to do it on your own? Will you try to stand on your own merit? Some say that the question is elementary, what will you do with Jesus? But it's not that easy. It happens rarely in our society that an adult chooses to follow Christ, chooses to reunite themselves with God through the sacrifice of Christ. Children tend to make that decision more often. To a child, that's good news. To an adult, that often means that I have to say no to some things that I've gotten pretty comfortable saying yes to. And that's why it's harder for an adult to make that decision. But nonetheless, it still is the question that we have to answer. As we move further into this book of Matthew, we will examine the people's responses, both individually and corporately, to the question of what should I do with Jesus? So if you have your little handout that I gave, we'll read verses 1 through 12. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. And when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And when he gathered all the chief priests and scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So they said to him, In Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler who shall shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, determined from them what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, Go search carefully for the young child, and when you have found them, bring word back to me that I may come and worship him also. When they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. And when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Then, being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed to their country by another way. The first thing we see in here is that we see that Herod is king. Jesus was born and that Herod is king. We'll let Herod go for a minute, but we'll come back to him. Suffice for now to know that he is a jealous, old, and nasty person. But as compared to him, the wise men do the proper thing when they come to Jesus. They address him as king. They pay tribute. But they're people of a very strict order in those days. You didn't come into another person's kingdom without visiting the king and acknowledging him. So they go to Herod and they ask him these questions. Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him. It says, Now when Herod heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with them. Now it says that they saw his star in the east. When it says they saw his star in the east, it doesn't mean they saw his star in the east. That makes sense, doesn't it? What it means is the star wasn't in the east, but when they were in the east, they saw his star. We know if we look at it, they traveled basically west to come to where Jesus was. While they were in the east, they saw a star. What the star was, we don't know for sure. Was it a planet? Was it a star? Was it a light? There's lots of theorizing about what it might have been. But whatever it was, it caused them sufficient excitement in order to follow that star. A lot of people feel it's very likely they were from Arabia and they traveled west to the place where Jesus was. Justin the historian states in five separate places that the wise men hail from Arabia. And in 1920s, British scholar E.F.F. Bishop visited a tribe in Jordan. This tribe bore the name Kokobani. Those who study, it means those who study or follow the planets. He asked the tribal elders, why such a name? They replied, because it was their ancestors who followed the planets and traveled west to Palestine to show great honor to the great prophet Jesus when he was born. Wherever they came from, they knew something special was going on. They were able to risk a lot to travel, a great expense to travel that far. It doesn't give us a great deal of information as to why they would, or why this was so important, or how they knew that this young person was going to be a king of the Jews. But their action was right. With the knowledge that they had, they came and they worshipped him. They gave him proper acceptance for who he was and who he could be. Some sources say there were just a few. Some say there were many. I read a couple that said there may have been accompanied by an army of thousands that stayed just outside the city gates of Herod. And just the wise men themselves went in. Regardless of how big they were, I read a couple of others that said they have tradition now that they even had names, that they have, some of them were dark-skinned, some of them were light-skinned, but this stuff is all pretty much speculation. It is interesting to know, though, that they gave him his proper place. And one of the phrases that I really liked in there was in verse 10, jumping ahead just for a minute, it says, when they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy when it came to over where the child was. I like the phrase exceedingly great joy. I think that, you know, our opinion of God being with us, our opinion of Jesus having done what he did for us, rarely brings us to a point of exceedingly great joy. Often we are very subdued in our appreciation for what God did. And why these particular people were able to have exceeding great joy is a very interesting observation. In verse 3 it says, when Herod heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with them. I think when we studied a little bit about Jonah, we saw that the societies were rough then. Physical violence was incredibly evident everywhere you went. Kings ruled with absolute authority, with absolute brutality. And I think when it says that in verse 8, when he says, go and search carefully for the young child, and when you have found him, bring word back to me that I may come and worship him. I wrote after there, seriously? I mean, do we really believe that that's really what he wanted to do? Did he really fool the wise men into believing that he was just a devout follower of Jesus, or wanted to be? Those wise men came from the same background, the same area as Herod did and the Jews in Jerusalem. And I don't think the Jews in Jerusalem were troubled because they worried about the baby. I think they were troubled because they worried about what Herod's response would be. Because in those days, when the king ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. And when the king decides to be brutal, he is unquestioned at what he decides to do. And they knew that if he was doing this, that there soon would be trouble to come. But let's look for a minute. As we said, Matthew's trying to build an argument, bring more and more proofs to bear that Jesus is who he said he was, and that he fulfilled the requirements of the Old Testament Messiah, and there's no reason for us not to believe him. And even if you missed him during his life, you could now accept him at this time. So we see in verse 5 and 6, in verse 6 it says, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. And that comes from Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And I'll just read that to you. But you, Bethlehem, Though you are little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of you shall come forth to me the one to be ruler of Israel, whose going forth are from old, from everlasting. And remember, although we don't know the Old Testament all that well, the Jewish people knew it really well. And so when he quotes this to a Jew, it makes sense to them. Okay, there's one more proof that Jesus is who he said he was. And we know that Bethlehem is the birthplace of David. It was called the city of David early on. So it is the right place for the Messiah to come from, and the place that royalty comes from in terms of the descendants of David down through Christ. In verse 9, we see, when they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them till it came over. And when they saw that star, they rejoiced and were exceedingly glad with great joy. And when they had come to the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother and fell down and worshipped him. When they opened their treasures, they presented him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. When Jesus was a baby, we often see in the nativity scene that the wise men are there, right? But we know that that's not really true. They weren't really there because Herod inquires how long ago they saw the star. And the end result of his inquiry, he decides to kill all the babies 2 years old and under. So we don't know exactly how long it was before, how old he was when the wise men came, but we assume it's under two and over one, somewhere in that category, and Herod's just going to play it safe by trying to annihilate anybody who could try to usurp his throne. So when the wise men come to Jesus, he is a small boy. Now, I don't know if you traveled across the desert many thousands or hundreds of miles and you were going to come to see a new king, what you would expect to see. But you might expect to see a palace, some place of formal residence. But they didn't come to that, did they? We know that Joseph and Mary weren't wealthy. It had to be a pretty basic place to live. And they were, when they came, they saw it as it was. Now, why is it that they had enough faith, even though they didn't come to a palace, they didn't come to anything fancy, that they still believed? They still were willing to give what probably was a pretty valuable asset to this young child. It's interesting to see that their response was correct to Jesus again. What will you do with Jesus? Well, they will worship him. They will give the stuff. But what was Herod's response? Why didn't Herod see the same thing? Herod knew Jewish tradition. He was at least half Jewish. He had grown very comfortable with where he was, and he wanted that power. He wanted that control. If you read about the wise men giving the gifts, you see that there's a lot of talk about, they were specially designed for gold for the king and myrrh because he would die someday and he would need it and all that sort of stuff. But, all that's pretty much speculation. Let's just suffice to say that the wise men felt it was sufficiently convinced that Jesus was who he said he was, that they would leave these incredibly valuable gifts there and then move on. They worshipped him, and that was the correct response. And then it says they followed it because of a dream. And I assume they were already suspicious of Herod, just as any king would be of another king at the time. They followed the dream and went home another way. And then in verse 13 it says, "Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, 'Arise, take the young child and his mother and flee to Egypt and stay there till I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy them.' And when he arose, he took the child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt. And he stayed there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which the Lord through the prophet saying, 'Out of Egypt I called my son.'" And that is in the book of Hosea, chapter 11, verse 1. It says, "When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." And so once again, Matthew is leaning upon the knowledge of the Jews, that they would understand that this would be a fulfillment of prophecy. One more reason why they could believe that Jesus was who he said he was. And now comes one of the sad parts of the New Testament. It says, Then Herod, when he saw he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he set forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and all the districts from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men, that it was fulfilled what was spoken by the Jeremiah the prophet, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they were no more. And that verse is exactly like that. And from Jeremiah 31:15 is where that is from. Once again, reinforcing to the Jews that he was who he said he was. Let's take a moment just to look at Herod and why he does what he does. We know that in that day, the power of the sword ruled the day. You had no rights except for that the king chose to let you live or not live. We saw that when we studied Jonah, the brutality of the leaders. Herod's father Antipater was forced to become a Jew at sword point during the Maccabean revolts. He was appointed leader of the area, procurator of the area by Julius Caesar in 47 BC, and it was conferred upon him Roman citizenship. The honor then descended to Herod. In 40 BC, there was a revolt in Israel, and Herod fled to Rome for protection. He had met Mark Antony there. They became lifelong friends. The Roman Senate made him king of Judea and sent him back. And in 37 BC, at the age of 36, he became the unchallenged ruler of Judea again, and he was king for 32 years. He was always at odds with the Pharisees because they considered him impure because he was only half Jewish. And in the wars between the Caesars, if you've studied any of Rome's history, he fought for Mark Antony against Octavian. And he was very loyal. And when Mark Antony and Cleopatra committed suicide, he was left having been their friend. A friend of the loser. He went to Octavius and he went with his crown in his hand and he explained to him, you know, I was loyal to the people I said. I never broke my word. Do with me what you will. And the emperor said, well, at least you were loyal. I will let you remain king in Judea and as long as you're loyal to me. And he proved to be. I don't know if you can imagine that sort of drama and dialogue. Your health, your life hangs by a thread the minute anybody decides that you should disappear. He was a bad person, but he also did many good things. He had a lot of public projects. He rebuilt the temple, and at a time of extreme poverty, he had the gold plate of the temple, of his palace, melted down and sold to buy food for the poor. So he did care. But he had an unnatural fear of losing power. I think that everyone would. And in that, he developed a dark and cruel streak. He had his wife murdered, her two sons murdered, her brother murdered, her grandfather and her mother. He altered his will 3 times, each time usually causing the death of somebody. He finally had his firstborn son killed. In all, he married 10 times. It was a fearful thing to marry a king in those days. Eventually, as he grew old and sick, he attempted suicide, but he was saved from suicide by a guard. His last order was to have his troops gather thousands of notables from across the country and sequester them in a stadium in Jericho. And upon his death, they were all to be executed so that there would be mourning for him, for the king. When he died, he knew there would be no actual mourning for him, but at least there would be mourning in the kingdom. Fortunately, when he died, the order was not carried out. But with his, and I have just barely touched what this gentleman was like in terms of brutality, but with a description even as much as I've given you, it's not hard to believe that he would have the babies killed in order to try to secure his throne for himself and his offspring. I think if we look back at that part where it said all Jerusalem was troubled It helps you understand that more. You know why they were troubled, because you knew that a king in those days was capable of this kind of atrocity should he choose to do it. And that's still the case in the world in some places today. So the bottom line is you have to decide what you will you do with Jesus. Mary had a choice. She was presented with a situation that was going to happen. She accepted what was going to come upon her. And if we read in Luke, we read even more of her response. Joseph also was faced with a choice. This is what's going to happen, and can you deal with this? Will you accept this person as the Christ? And he did. The wise men also made a right choice when they saw that there was going to be a king born, and they followed him. Herod, I think we could safely assume, did not make the right choice. He could have made that right choice. I mean, obviously, the child wasn't going to grow up and usurp his throne for a while. And yet, sin had just entered his soul and taken such control of him that that he made the wrong choice, and a brutal choice, which he'll always be remembered for. Remember in Matthew 1:21, and it's not on your sheet anymore. I moved it off there, but in Matthew 1:21, it says, "And she shall bring forth a son, and you shall call his name Jesus." And we all know that that's what the Jews were waiting for. They were waiting for the Messiah to come, a son to come, and they would call his name Jesus. But what did the Jews want him to do when they came? They wanted him to save the country from the elephant, right? They said, Rome is the bad. He's coming. He's going to save us from the elephant. But what's the last half of that verse? Does it say in 1:21, "And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he will save you from Rome"? Doesn't say that, does it? It says, "He will save his people from their sins." And see, this is the way God is. He doesn't come to save us. He didn't bring Jesus to save us from an over-oppressive husband. He didn't bring Jesus to save us from an over-oppressive wife. He didn't bring Jesus to save us from our government or another government. He brought Jesus to save us from ourselves. And our biggest enemy is not what others are doing. Even though we'd like to claim it and say it and complain about the elephant, our biggest enemy is the evil that's within us, is always wants to get out. Now, when we accept Christ, we no longer have to be accountable for that, right? Christ, there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. We don't stand before God in our merit, in the goodness that we have done. Maybe you could, or maybe you think you could. I know I couldn't. It says, in his presence every knee will bow. And the beautiful part is after what Christ has done for us, we can stand there humbly thankful, but confident that we have a means to be with God again. So when you put Jesus in his right place, it should be completed. That whole idea should be completed with humility on your part and thankfulness on your part. And just the joy of knowing that I don't have to introvert about my sin every day, all day long. That's not going to help me. All it's going to do is drag me further down. I need to look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of my faith, and take great comfort in his love and compassion. And if I could reach the point where, like the wise men did, where I can accept that with exceedingly great joy, then maybe that joy would flow out of me into the people I come across every week, and they could say, there's something different. Where does that joy come from in a harsh world? And so often we're so worried about what I called the elephant, we forget to have joy in that he came to save me from myself. And it's quite a job for him, for me. I don't know about for you guys. Maybe it's easier for him, for you. But let's just hope that we give God the place and Jesus the place in our life that he intended it to be, and that the benefit is to his glory and witness to those around us that is a better way to go. Let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you for your goodness to us. Thank you for any lessons we can learn and we can gain from your scripture. Thank you for protecting us from ourselves and help us to keep our eyes on you. And I ask this in Jesus' name, amen.